Okay. So, angelology, I call this presentation Angelology 101. So, like, if you were taking this in college, freshman, right, angelology, what would they teach you? First, the very term angel. Remember, angel is like a job description. What these beings are spirits. In other words, they are completely free from matter. They're completely free from matter. They never had bodies, never will have bodies. We call them angels, and really what we're describing there is their relationship with us. Angelos is the Greek word for messenger. So if you were reading Homer or you were reading any the Iliad, the Odyssey, the word angelos, it's not a spirit. They're just the messenger from one camp to another. But we call these spiritual beings messengers because they are the primary way that God makes himself known to us. Okay? The church fathers take it for granted that throughout the Old Testament, visitations or appearances of God are largely being carried out through angels. That God is not necessarily appearing in person all the time. You know, if you're the CEO, you're not the one who's delivering all the messages, right? There are times that you make an appearance, but you got people who work for you. They're out there delivering the messages. Okay? You're told throughout the Old Testament that the chosen people are being led by angels, they're being protected by angels, they're being guided by angels. That language is throughout the Old Testament. Okay? How were angels ordered or organized? Okay? You get several terms for angels. For example, in the Old Testament, you're told about the seraphim, right? Remember, these are the ones who were in the presence of God in Isaiah. They're the ones who are shouting to each other, "Holy, holy, holy." Okay? Remember, it's not like baby, 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 or love you, love. Remember, in Hebrew, there are no superlatives. They don't have good, better, best, or bad, worse, worst. What they do in Hebrew is good, 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 good. Yeah. So in other words, holy, 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 they are saying most holy. They are in the presence of God, and they are calling out that God is most holy. The cherubim, remember the cherubim appear in a couple different places. They're the ones with the flaming sword after Adam and Eve are expelled. They are the angels that are carved on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And those two are connected. Because remember, the Ark of the Covenant is in the Holy of Holies. That's where God is present. Those cherubim there that remind you of where God was present with Adam and Eve. And now that gate is closed, right? There is the cherubim with the flaming sword. There are a whole bunch of the names, thrones, principalities, powers, dominions, virtues that occur in St. Paul. They occur in Colossians. They occur in Ephesians. And then you have these other terms that occur throughout Scripture, archangels, which means a princely angel, and then just the generic term angel. Okay? And the understanding very early on is that these are arranged in a hierarchy, upper and down. There are higher angels, there are lower angels. Angels are unequal. They're fundamentally unequal because each angel is a different kind of thing. When we are all human beings, but what makes you human over there and me human over here is that I am human nature in this body and bones and flesh and so on. You are humanity over there in that flesh, bones, body, and so on. So we can all have the same nature and be distinct individuals because it's our material components in a way that separate us. For angels, they aren't like that. They aren't meant to be in a body. They've never been in bodies. So what that means is each angel is its own kind. An angel is different from an angel like triangle or circle from square. It's like that. Or the way that a badger would be different from a woodchuck, and a woodchuck would be different from a giraffe, and a giraffe would be different from an aardvark. They are different like that. So, people, probably since you were very little, have looked you in the eye and told you, you are special. There is no one quite like you. Okay, well, that's actually not true. You're not a species unto yourself. You're human. You all share in human nature, and in fact, that's what makes you important, is that you share in this nature that God has given you. But angels, they really are special. They are one of a kind. Each individual angel is its own kind. Angels are, because they're spiritual, they are disembodied minds and wills. So for us, we have minds and wills, but our minds and wills work through our body. Right? Try to think of something without having an image or a picture. Right? Your mind depends on things that get through the senses and through the body to do its work. But angels are infused intelligences. So I give this especially to the sophomores. I get a nice big book. I don't have any books in here. But I take one of the bio books. You know, those like, they're like Third Webster's Intercollegiate Dictionary kind of thing. You know, and I'll put it on my head. And I'll say, okay, imagine putting this book on your head, going to sleep. You wake up in the morning, right? And you take the book off, and now it's all there. It's all there. All the diagrams are there. The glossary's there, right? And of course, some of these kids in bio, right? It's like a dream come true, right? How do I sign up for this? And I said, that's what it's like to be an angel. Your knowledge is infused. Your understanding of the universe is infused. You are a mind full of ideas. You are a mind full of concepts. For us as human beings, oh my gosh, we come into the world with nothing, and sometimes it feels like we leave with nothing. You need to have experiences and instruction and examples. You need all of these things to get anything in your head, and you need an idea for everything that you encounter. Like what I was doing before, aardvark, giraffe, right? Animal, right? A circle, square, triangle. You need ideas for all those things and words for all those things. And that's why it takes so long for us to learn anything. Angels, they are intelligences full of ideas. That's how they're created. Okay? Now, one of the things I say, because inevitably you're going to get that kind of like science boy, you know, how do we know there are angels? How do we know angels are real? I mean, how do you know any of this, right? If you can't do it in a lab, if you can't go out and like capture an angel and dissect it, right? How do you know? And one of the things I share with them is this article by Peter Kraft of Boston College. This guy must be 105 now. I mean, he just keeps chugging along and writing books and whatnot. We should all be so energetic in our 80s. But he talks about how it is that, you know, can I prove angels to you or prove them in some kind of scientific way? No. But remember, science doesn't address those things in you that are really distinctively human. What makes you human is that you have a mind, that you have a will. Those are things that are immaterial. Those are things that science doesn't address. Notice that when science wants to talk about human nature, it always wants to boil it to material things that really end up evaporating what makes you distinctively human. It keeps wanting to talk about you in terms of biochemical processes or neurological machinery. You get to the end of that and you have human beings who are essentially machines. We're flesh robots. We're meat robots. We're not beings that really have mind or will or understand the good or choose the good. Whenever you take that purely scientific approach, all the things that really are at the heart of being human, right, they just evaporate. So Kraft's pushback, if you like, is, yes, science doesn't address those things, but science doesn't address the things that really make you human in the first place. Okay? But if you're willing to grant, you know, work with me. Let's start out as a working hypothesis that you could have beings that are not material, that are purely spiritual. What would they be like? Okay, you know, just from the nature of this thing, it's not going to eat, right? It's not going to need nourishment. It's not going to sleep. It's not going to be born. It's not going to have any kind of sexuality. You see, when two angels care about each other very much, they come. You're not going to have any of that, right? They are created, but they are not. They are not co-creators. They're not going to make little angels, right? They're not going to be vulnerable in the way that we as human beings are vulnerable. They're not going to get sick. They're not going to get wounded, right? They're not going to have any of those things. You can't get throat infections if you don't have a throat. You can't get stomach flu if you don't have a stomach. Right, they are not going to have any of those problems. Okay? They are not going to have emotions in the way that we have emotions. Okay? They're going to have that. Think about it this way. I mean, when you're afraid that maybe there's this like this coppery taste of fear, when you blush, you're embarrassed, and you turn a lovely pink. When you you're excited about something, your heart beats faster. Well, these are beings that, to the extent they have emotions, there's no physical dimension to that. So it wouldn't be emotions like the way that we have emotions. They have wills, but they don't have emotions, not in that physical way. Okay. Even with all those great things, though, it's important to understand the limitations of angels. And I find that people who are thinking about this for the first time, they confuse a lot of angelic traits with really divine traits. Okay, they confuse those things. So what do I mean by that? Angels do not naturally know God. Your picture is that somehow like there's this spiritual realm and all these spirits like hang out together. So angels, of course, from the moment they exist, they're sort of in the presence of God. No. Angels have to be given that just like we do. Naturally, of course, they're going to know more about the universe and more about God than we would, but they aren't going to be naturally united to God mentally by just being created. So when we talk about a fall of the angels, what that means is the angels have this natural knowledge of God and the universe. They're being offered a supernatural knowledge. Some of them accept that and others don't. And the angels that don't accept what God is offering, those are the beings that we call devils. They have turned away. They have turned away from the light and become darkness. Okay, to use the expression of John. Okay, one of the things that I use as an image for them, your picture of the spiritual realm is like the way that if you're a middle class person in a middle class neighborhood, you think of all these rich people living together. Like, they're the rich people over there. And what you don't get is that actually there are distinctions among the rich. There are the rich people who have, let's say, a nice 5,000 square foot house right by the lake. And then there's like the super rich. There's like Bill Gates with his mansion of 65 rooms. There's, you know, Will Smith, whose estate is big enough that it has its own zip code. Okay? Many folks are rich, but they're not estate with its own zip code, 65-room mansion rich. That's the way you have to think about God and the angels. Yes, they're all spirits. That doesn't change the fact that God is infinitely above those other spirits. That he's infinitely above all those angels. He is not naturally known to them in a comprehensive way. That is something that God has to give himself to the angels. Angels do not know the future because angels are not completely outside time. They're less outside of time than we are, but because they don't have bodies. But to be completely outside of time, that's a privilege that belongs to God. Remember, God is the author of the book. Everybody else is going through the narrative. They're going through the story. Okay? So if you're reading Frankenstein or Pride and Prejudice, right? You are going through the story. The characters, their actions are unfolding right to you and to each other. But like, you know, for Mary Shelley or for Jane Austen, all of those events are before them, the author, at once. They can mentally move backwards or forwards in that because they're the author of it. Okay? And the angels are like the characters. They are not able to, as it were, get above the events. They're in the events. Now, the thing I point out is angels can nonetheless be great predictors, right? We had this presentation before spring break, so I told them, if you get March Madness tips from an angel, take it! Take it! If you get stock market advice from an angel, take it! Because they are going to be able to bring that information and project forward in a way much better than any human intellect can. But it's not, they are not, as it were, closing their eyes and the future appears to them. They're not doing that. They are predicting in the same way that a human being would. Okay? Angels are not able to just look in your thoughts. They're not able to just read your mind. Again, the only being that can know you from the inside is your maker. That's the only being that can know you from the inside. Now, I said, at the same time, your guardian angel, your accompanying devil, they've been watching you your whole life. They've heard every conversation you've ever had. They've read every text you've ever sent, right? So, and of course, the kids get all... They are not always prudent about what they put in a text. So the moment you tell them he's read every text, oh, there, now he has my soul, right? He has my, I've unburdened the whole of my life in my texts, right? I don't have a chance. The moment that you put it out there, of course, that's something that he can hear and see and read. And remember, you don't have to read somebody's mind to know what they're going to do. These are beings that have been watching your whole life, and anybody who knows you really well, they can, hey, I know what you're thinking. They'll tell you that. And it's not because they look in your mind, they've seen this all before. You may feel as though your mother reads your mind. You may feel that. And she's been watching you the whole of your life. You're not going to fool her. So, but she's not like looking in your mind. By the way, I will always have students who, no, she looks in my mind. So moms, it's working. This thing you're doing, it's working. They really do think you can read their minds. Okay. So in fact, right, only God can know you from the inside. Finally, your devil, a devil cannot take your will. Right? Devils can't force you to do anything. They can only work with a will that is to some degree open. So I don't spend a lot of time on this. I don't want to arouse the morbid part of their curiosity. But I say when you look at demonic possession, nobody is possessed against their will. They have opened their will in some way. So for example, in the book, William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, and then the movie based on the book. In the book and in the movie, Reagan, remember, opens herself to the possessing spirit by fooling around with the Ouija board. That doesn't mean everybody who fools around with the Ouija board gets possessed, but you've opened a door. Okay? You've opened a door. When William Peter Blatty wrote that book, he wrote it based on a real exorcism and a real possession that had happened in the late 1940s in Iowa. And then the exorcism, in fact, took place over several months. And it was finished on the campus of St. Louis University by two Jesuit exorcists. It was a little boy, and not a little girl. And the way this boy had become possessed, his grandmother was a spiritualist. Remember, this was a fad in the late 1800s, early 20th century. Uncle Cuthbert! Right, you'd have seances, and you'd have, Uncle Cuthbert, are you there? Right, people trying to get in touch with their relatives. Grandma dies, and then the grandson is using some of her techniques to try to reach out to grandma. Well, the spirit shows up, saying it's grandma, but it's not grandma. So that's if you're, how do people get possessed? Are they saying, devil, come get me? No, but it could be they're opening a door to something that they don't understand what's on the other side of that door. Okay, it's there's an image of it in if you watch. Not the new vampire movies, which were all like, they're all like zombie movies. They're all like everybody turns into a zombie, everybody turns into a vampire. So Christopher Lee, way back in the 1950s, the folklore about vampires was they couldn't just go in your house. You had to invite them in. That was the idea. A vampire couldn't just show up. And what's an imitation of is this reality of the demonic. The demonic can't, as it were, just, invade. There has to be a way in which it's invited. You've opened your will. Now, the problem, of course, is once you've opened your will, it's very difficult to get rid of this thing. And that's where the church's ritual of exorcism comes in. Okay, so although spirits, angels, devils, they're very powerful, they're not all powerful, they're not divine, right? They have limitations, and all those things are important limitations. Okay. One of the things that I have to help students understand when you talk about them being separated from the body, that they are spirits, you are never becoming an angel. Okay? Grandma's died and she's with the angels now. Okay, yes, you mean she's gone to heaven, but you don't mean that she's sprouted wings. I'm very sorry to say that I don't have to talk kids out of the theological error of It's a Wonderful Life, because unfortunately none of these kids watch It's a Wonderful Life. So Clarence Oddbody, angel second class, he's working hard to get his wings. I actually have to sit there and explain the movie to them because it does reflect this confusion at one point that people become angels. No, you are meant to have a body. So when you die and you know your soul is separated from the body, even if you're enjoying the beatific vision, you are incomplete. There's something incomplete about you. You are meant to be reunited with the body. That is, you know, in this Easter season, this is something that's so important about the resurrection of the body. If I may complain briefly about the Catholic clergy, one of my gripes in the Easter season is that almost none of these rascals will preach about their glorified body. This is very important in Christian belief because, you know, this is like keeping your eye on the prize. The difficulties of the Christian life make sense. They are resolved if not only we have the vision of God, but also that all the sorrows that have come through the body, that we get our body back, that it's a glorified body, that it's subtle, that it's spiritual, that it's agile, all these wonderful qualities that St. Paul talks about in the first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15. Criminy, talk about the glorified body. Union with God is not easy to understand. That's not. That you'd have some kind of vision of truth and goodness and beauty that's super abundant. That's not easy to get. But everybody can get that they are going to be in a completely healthy, youthful, energetic body, free from disease or any wound or any age. Everybody can get that. And that's a wonderful reward to have at the end for the rigors of the Christian life. Okay, so we are meant to have bodies. We're not meant to just be separated spirits. Hence, this is the difference between a ghost and an angel. Okay, ghosts are they're incomplete human beings. To be a ghost, like you think of Odysseus in the underworld. He sees his mother in the underworld, Eurycleia, and he tries to hug her, and it goes right through because she's just a disembodied spirit. You are incomplete. You are meant to be together with a body. Angels aren't, you know, never had bodies, never will. In the Old Testament, you can see these episodes like the young men who come to Abraham or the book of Tobit, where Tobit is accompanied by Raphael and Raphael guides him and talks to him. There's a great text, in fact, from Tobit where Raphael says, you know, I am an angel. I'm one of the angels who stand before God. And though I have eaten with you and drunk with you, this is an appearance. You are seeing a vision. Right? He tells him that directly. I've got to appear in some kind of way so that we can interact. If you have a being that's purely spiritual, that's going to make it hard for conversations. That's going to make it hard to know whether or not he's really hearing this or getting this, like talking with the incorporeal air, with vacancy. No, you've got to have someone, you've got to have something physically before you. So angels, what are they doing? In a way, it's almost like they're creating a hologram, like they're almost creating something visual for you to see. They're creating almost a kind of an optical illusion, but they are not taking on a body. They're not incarnating themselves. Okay, that's not what an angel is doing. To stick with Scripture for a moment, when you look at the opening of Genesis, you know, it doesn't have, and on the 11th day, God created angels. And inevitably, there are students who want to know, well, where are the angels created, and how come I'm not being told? By the way, some of these are the same students who want to know where the dinosaurs are. And, of course, that's an easy one to answer. You know, we didn't find evidence of dinosaurs until, I want to say, the 1800s. What would people have thought if they read a book which talked about these giant lizards roaming the earth when there was no evidence for that for, like, centuries? Wouldn't you have thought the book was, like, bogus? Right? And after everybody had rejected it. And then you dig up the bones. Oh, there are these things that the Bible said there were. And more importantly, however cool dinosaurs are, not knocking dinosaurs, totally cool, they aren't actually helpful for faith and morals. I mean, that's ultimately what the Bible's about. It's not about all these cool things in nature. So, where are the angels? Why aren't they just laid out? Notice on day one, God creates the light, and he separates the light from the darkness. When St. Augustine reads that passage, he will say that light is not a spiritual light. It's not a physical light. How do you know it's not a physical light? Because you don't have sun, moon, stars, you don't have those things until day four. Day four is when you get all those physical lights. So you need to understand that this light is metaphoric, okay? That it's a figure of something. Now, by the way, it's very the move that Augustine makes there, I think, is very important for us to learn from. Our tendency is, I know these things from modern science, and so when I go read Scripture, what I do is I try to force Scripture to fit what it is that I know from modern science. That is not what Augustine does. Augustine says, I'm going to have the faith that God is teaching me something true, and so I'm going to pay attention to what the text tells me. So he's always guided by the text, not from some kind of external authority. And that tends to be the problem for us as modern people. Science for us is an authority. And it's not, how to put this, it's not that science is somehow wrong or distorted, but you never know at any particular point, you know, how true whatever science is telling you. Just think about, I'll use examples that are sort of ordinary ones that we all grew up with. Remember the food pyramid? Remember the bottom of that food pyramid? You are supposed to be like eating all these carbs. I mean, you would be laughed out of a nutrition class if you said that now. And that was something that was in the 60s and 70s, that food pyramid was taught as a fact. If you had rejected that, you would have gotten, well, they wouldn't have known to say this yet, but you would have gotten, science is real. Right? People would have, if they had had the phrase to use. So now we don't believe that anymore. So how at any given point do you know that this thing that's authoritative? And quite frankly, with 16-year-olds, I could stand up there and say, a study at the University of Ohio over a 3-year period has shown, and I could say anything after that, and they would believe me. As long as I give a university, I give a sample, I give a date, right? I mean, these are like tablets descending from the sky that God is revealing something. Especially if I throw in like Ohio and Michigan. I don't know what it is. There's something about a University of Michigan study. Fact, fact, right? The University of Michigan has spoken. Okay. So when Augustine looks at that passage, okay, well, why is it that we're being told the creation of spirits, but we're being told it in a figure? Why not just come up, like all these kids who hate lit because they hate symbolism? Why can't it just say, and he created angels? I have to remind them, what was kind of the problem that the Hebrew people had? Okay, let me paint a picture for you. There's Moses on top of the mountain. He's getting things revealed to him. There are the people. They're getting impatient. And what do? And some of them, they think, are they partying? Are they, okay, you're right, they're partying. Partying, why? And then all of a sudden, calf, something about a calf. Gold, golden calf. Ah! Okay, those people, the Hebrew people, you're thinking they're Hebrews. They believe in one God. That took a very long time. That took a very long time for them to believe in one God. Do you think it's a good idea with these folks who are polytheists to come down to them and say, there is a God, there are three persons in that God, and there are millions of spirits? That is a very bad idea. Okay, I will tell them, you know, it's not unlike the way that you carry out sex ed with children. The 5-year-old comes and says, Mommy, where do babies come from? And you say, they come from Mama's tummy. And the child is happy with that. Good, they come from Mama's tummy. Away they go. Now, they're going to come back at like 8 or 9. How'd the baby get in your tummy? Oh, look at the time. Now I got to go pick up your father. No, now you come up with something else. You give the kid, in other words, enough information, but not more. You almost like the military. You tell them what they need to know at any given point, and you don't want to give too much. That is the way that Scripture gives you information about the angels. You get progressively more as Revelation goes on, but you're always being told things on a need-to-know basis. So at first, there's almost no talk about angels at all. Eventually, more angels start appearing, but they look like people. Eventually, in the book of Psalms, you start hearing about them being spirits. And then once you get to the New Testament, now you just get a lot more information. But you're getting a lot more information because by the time that Jesus has come, these are people, they're not polytheists anymore. They got other problems, but they are not polytheists. These are not people who are going to believe there are many gods, or they get that there is one God. They have gotten that down. You could say, by the way, note the same thing about the devil. In the beginning of Scripture, what do you have? The serpent. You're not told about devils. There's this serpent, and it's the wisest of the beasts. Then later on, you're told that that serpent was actually the devil, Satan. When does Satan first appear? He doesn't appear in his own proper person until the book of Job. And even then, the book of Job is a very strange book, right? Devil comes up, talks to God, God talks back, they make bets. Consider my servant Job, there is none like him on the earth. Oh, you strike him skin for skin and he'll curse you, you're on, right? It is a very strange book, but that is the first time that you meet the devil as a character, as a person. And then after that, he kind of disappears again. And you don't see him again until the gospel. You don't see him again until Matthew 4. There is Christ out in the desert, and now the devil comes to tempt him. Also think about this. In the Old Testament, there's no demonic possession. Does that mean there wasn't any happening? My inclination is to think that it's happening, but it's not talked about. Because otherwise it would drive you to despair. If you were to have an understanding of how much power the devil had before the coming of Christ, that would be terrifying. You don't get that full information until Christ comes. When Christ comes, then it's as if the veil is pulled off. I have to say, as somebody who did not pick up the Gospel of Matthew, I didn't pick it up until I was 16. I did not have a Catholic upbringing. I didn't have a Christian upbringing. My father was a fallen away Catholic, and nothing. By the way, Easter, until I came into the church, I thought Easter was eggs and chocolate bunnies. I had no idea that it had anything to do with the resurrection of Christ. How would I have? I went to a public school. Nobody talked about that. There wasn't anything. There was like the Charlie Brown Christmas special can kind of give you an idea of Christmas. And it came to pass that Caesar Augustus made a census of the whole world. Remember, Linus is on that stage in that. They didn't do an Easter special about the resurrection. Then I would have known. Right? Charles Schultz is responsible for me not knowing that the Easter was about the resurrection of Jesus. No. I picked up the Gospel of Matthew out of curiosity. And the thing that really struck me reading it was all the demonic possession. That was the thing, because my idea of Christianity as a kid growing up in the 70s with Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell and all that, this was a hippie religion. This was like, love your brother, love your neighbor, right? Off the pigs, free Huey, right? That's sort of what my picture of Christianity was. And that there would be devils, that they would have power, that Jesus would be expelling them. My gosh, this looks like The Exorcist more than it looks like Jesus Christ Superstar. In other words, that there was this great cosmic spiritual battle going on. That's just very evident, even on a superficial reading of the Gospel of Matthew. Okay, that was something that you don't get that battle. You don't get that picture until the New Testament. In other words, you don't get it until the cavalry's arrived. You don't get it until Jesus is there to give you the confidence this can be won. If all you had was that reality, you know, sort of in the Old Testament, really you would despair. So important things moving forward with reading the Screwtape Letters. The Screwtape Letters, you can tell in those first opening lines, there are two quotes there, one from Luther and one from Thomas More. Luther, of course, founder of the Lutheran Communion, Thomas More, Catholic saint of the Reformation. And there are quotes about how the devil doesn't want to be mocked, doesn't want to be ridiculed, doesn't want to be flouted or jeered, right? And that's a tip off of the kind of book you're reading. You are reading a work of satire. You are reading a work that it has comic elements because he's humanizing these devils, right? There's Uncle Screwtape and Wormwood's his nephew, and they're writing each other letters. By the way, I will tell them, these were letters that were found in the back of Magdalene College. You could tell they were diabolic because they were like burnt around the edges. You know, a lot of the kids just start smiling, but there are always some kids who, they're like getting this down in their notes. Like, stop! I'm having you on. He humanizes them. You look at the end of the letters, your affectionate uncle. Okay, it's not unlike the other works of satire that I can refer them to. For example, Animal Farm. You know, Animal Farm is about Soviet Russia. It's a very grim topic. But by putting it with pigs and horses and farm animals, you can make a point. And it's not as disturbing it would be if you read, like, for example, Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago. That's tough reading. Or Kessler's Darkness at Noon, or any of those kind of books. It's meant to make that point, but make it in a way that it goes down easier. So as you're reading the Screwtape letters, on the one hand, there are things which are comic. You're allowed to laugh. But there's a serious point behind it. And that's what satire does. It takes something comic but allows you to see something true about human nature or society or whatnot. Probably, you know, the thing that's most helpful about the Screwtape letters is not so much what it says about the devil as what it says about us. I would think even if you were a non-believer, even if you had no religion at all, the thing about the Screwtape letters that you would need to be open to is there are a lot of things that Lewis is talking about that really are human nature. They really are our moral vulnerabilities. And you know, you get more out of it as a Christian. You get more out of it as a believer. But ultimately, in a way, the subject of the satire is not necessarily the devils. In a way, the subject of the satire is us. It's hard to get a clear picture of who we are, of what our motivations are, of what our vulnerabilities are. It's very difficult for us to be honest with ourselves. And that's one of the things that Screwtape Letters allows for. Well, I'm sorry we got a late start, but I will share slides with Mrs. Cummins. And if you have any questions, feel free, if the week's going on, if you have any questions or whatnot, feel free to email me here, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thank you. Thank you.
So we'll come back May 18th and hear about Screwtape.
Okay.
May 18th, same day, same time.
Same bat time, same bat channel.